Kant's Realism and Idealism. Ayn Rand, in one of her television interviews, described the philosopher Immanuel Kant as the real villain of our age. I felt sad listening to that, but I understood why she was saying that. Like most scientists, she wanted to stick with the empirical data and how a rational mind would interpret them, rather than creating ideas about the reality from one's subjective experiences. Kant divided human experience into two broad categories, noumenal and phenomenal, or realism versus idealism. The terminologies and their interpretations by various philosophers can be confusing, but to put it simply, transcendental realism is the view that regards space and time, including objects in the world, as real, and they exist independent of our sensibilities. Second, transcendental idealism is the doctrine that says all cognitions through the senses and experience is nothing but sheer illusion, and there is truth only in the ideas of pure understanding and reason. Kant typically distinguishes two varieties of transcendental idealism. Dogmatic idealism, which claims that objects in space do not exist, and problematic idealism, which claims that objects in space may exist, but we can't know whether they do. Kant's view of transcendental idealism is remarkably similar to the concept of Maya in ancient Indian philosophy, which suggests that this world is just a Maya or illusion, and we should view it as a dream with no real consequences for our soul. A friend once questioned me about this hard-to-believe Indian thought that this world is not real, and the reality cannot be perceived through the five senses or our rational interpretation. He asked, "Does that mean my flesh and bones are not real, or my house is not real?" My answer to that was, "Yes, they're all real matter at a gross level, and calling them flesh, bones, and the house is a mental construct of our waking consciousness. And when a shift in consciousness occurs because of being in deep meditation, one is transported out of their normal consciousness into a different level. And from that standpoint, they are seen as blobs of energy and vibrations constantly in flux. And that would be the reality from an astral level." Perhaps seeing real things as unreal needs some explanation. When people say dreams are unreal, it does not mean that the fact you dreamt it was unreal, or the chemicals and thoughts involved in producing the vision in a dream were unreal, or the racing of your heart when you had a horrible dream was unreal. In the same way, when an Indian yogi says, "This world is unreal, just a dream," he's not denying the existence of the physical structure, but the way we look at it and the narrative we hold is unreal. It's like when putting things under a microscope makes the gross thing disappear. In the same way, with divine eye, the normal waking spectacles disappear, which was anyway not accurate due to the gap between things as they are and as we perceive them. With dreaming, everything about our dreams is real except for the story or the narrative we hold at the time. And we can't know that the narrative is not true for as long as we are in the dream. In the same way, when we achieve higher consciousness, The spectacle of this world appears fragmented and in a flux. Like yogis say that the mental image that we are holding in our mind's eye under normal waking consciousness is Maya, the illusion. Imagine for a moment that your eyes were seeing things through the lenses of an electron microscope. This world will disappear. And you may say that the world you were familiar with was the reality as it appeared to my eyes. And this is the real world. The electron microscope leads to deconstruction of our mental constructs. That is, the concept of beauty and ugliness may get fudged. Using another example, the transcendental realism is like seeing this world as a snake, and transcendental idealism is seeing it as a piece of rope. The snake has become unreal the moment we see it is a rope, although the physical structure of the rope is very much there. You can't have both these notions at the same time. The moment you perceive the thing as a rope, the perception of it being a snake disappears. It becomes unreal. Both cannot coexist. When we say the perception of a snake was Maya or illusion, we don't mean that something was not there, but the narrative we were holding about it was an illusion. Using the microscopic eye, the distinction between a human being or an animal or a plant or rock disappears. All you see is concentrated blobs of particles, energy scattered around unevenly and connected with each other in an inseparable way. Just as the existence of a dream and its biochemical composition in the brain was a reality, but not the content of it. The presence of an emotion or thought are reality, but not their content or narrative, which is what Indian philosophy says, and Kant's philosophy is consistent with it. One might say using microscopic eye is an escape from our working reality and madness, and you will not want to hold on to that reality forever. But the reality is that this working level of consciousness comes with eventual unhappiness. Therefore, the Buddha said life is suffering, and the microscopic vision comes with unending joy. What would you choose? Some still choose the working reality, as the microscopic vision is too much for them to bear, and alien as well. But the majority get motivated to engage in pursuits to make the microscope vision last longer and longer. A single microscopic vision changes their life completely. We have come across several case studies where a single LSD or magic mushroom trip was able to cure people of their PTSD, depression, and suicidal thoughts. I must point out here that one should not attempt that until further scientific research has proved such treatments safe. Now moving on to rationalism. Ayn Rand has insisted that one should only be guided by rational thinking. Carl Gustav Jung has, in his book Modern Man in Search of a Soul, said the tragedy of the modern Western man is that the rational side of his mind is too developed and he is cut off from his instinctual side. People in the Western world don't live by their instincts, which is why they are less content, less spiritual, and less emotionally agile, as it requires being connected to the totality of our emotions and the whole of our being. He felt that from a spiritual point of view, tribal people and those in the Eastern world were better connected with their being. Jung has described two distinct types of thinking. Number one, the directed, logical and rational, the thinking of our conscious mind. Second, the spontaneous, imaginative, largely non-verbal and non-logical processes, largely of the unconscious mind, which can be said to form the raw material for all forms of creative activity. In view of this, wanting to live only by the rational thought will stifle our creativity, spirituality, and our transcendental self. Having said that, losing our foothold on the rational objective facts will also be dangerous, as we'll be burning witches at the stake. We should therefore stay grounded in the rational thought, but venture out into our dreams, fantasies, instincts, etc., to experience wholeness and integration, and sometimes be willing to be guided by them. Coming back to the rationality in the financial world, there is no rational formula to decide the salary of people. Free market can decide earnings of a footballer or a film star, but it would be difficult for the free market to decide the salary of a NASA scientist who can tell us if we can live on the Mars, a human biologist who can find a cure for corona, or a lawmaker. Now, these best minds are being paid much less than the property agents and online grocers. Where is the rational formula to apportion value to their work, and who will pay them if free market is indifferent to that need? How to decide whether a nurse should get paid more than a primary school teacher or a police officer? A free market will lead to a very lopsided growth of the society. The philosophy behind free market economy is that the society decides what is best, not the governments. But how many of us understand the complexities of the human body, our financial institutions, or artificial intelligence to make rational decisions about our healthcare, finances, and IT systems? It must be left to experts to make those decisions. The decision makers will not knock on each door to seek public opinion. The public will be appointing their representatives to make those decisions after studying the arguments for and against such decisions. And our members of parliament, that is government, are these people, and public should trust them and not get paranoid about them. Next is laissez-faire capitalism. Ayn Rand vilified government regulations because they hinder freedom. In her collection of 1984 essay on the virtue of selfishness, there is no compromise between freedom and government controls. One feels that after adopting laissez-faire capitalism, one will become free of government coercion and live happily ever after. Sadly, they have not realized that they will be collaborating with big corporate giants who are capable of exerting, and they are already exerting, greater coercion. People across the world, irrespective of which country they live in, feel more coerced when working in private sector than in the public sector. It's a different matter that financial rewards are greater in the private sector. The conclusion is that there is going to be some control or coercion. If you don't like government coercion, you will have coercion of the corporate bosses, which may be worse. Of course, total government control, as seen with some totalitarian regimes, will not be in the best interest of an average citizen and should be opposed. At the same time, creating a free society and leaving vulnerable people at the mercy of rich will not be a clever idea. I recently watched Milton Friedman, a Nobel Prize-winning U.S. economist and a libertarian, being interviewed on television. Picking up just one example from that interview, he said that U.S. government should get rid of the FDA. Let the responsibility of safety of drugs be with the pharmaceuticals, and let them face the lawsuits if something goes wrong. They will become more responsible, and the society will do the same job anyway if the FDA was not there. I'm thinking about how much pressure and coercion the employees of the pharma industry will have to go through. Each pharmaceutical company will have to create a mini FDA within their own organization. And will the truth ever come out in time if the survival of the company was at stake? We need someone who does not have their vested interest to make those decisions. Next, the virtue of selfishness. Ayn Rand was right here. The Buddha left his wife and his one-year-old son to pursue his own happiness. Was he not pursuing the virtue of selfishness as taught by Ayn Rand? The flight attendants, in case of an emergency, tell you that you must first wear your own oxygen mask and then help your child. Is it not a lesson along similar lines? You can't help others if you are unable to help yourself. If your pot is empty, you can't pour anything into someone else's pot. Without the Buddha leaving his house and attaining enlightenment, his son would not have reached the first stage of enlightenment, that is Nibbana. Without first putting on your own oxygen mask, you will not be able to help your child. Ayn Rand's philosophy appeals to young, impressionable minds because they have yet to fill their pots of their life. Asking them to worry about someone else's pot will not make any sense to them. But once you have achieved success in your life, achieving more success does not give you the same level of thrill or joy. That is what midlife crisis is about. The answer to our issues at that stage of our life are not material but spiritual. We see many super rich, shrewd business people becoming philanthropists, but hardly see any philanthropist becoming a shrewd businessman later in life. Why billionaires are not leaving behind their money entirely to their family? What satisfaction do they get? In their financial wisdom, which may perhaps be greater than that of Ayn Rand, they chose to return part of it back to the society. Perhaps to earn money, they did follow Ayn Rand's philosophy of the virtue of selfishness, making no concessions to their customers. Be it Bill Gates or Warren Buffett in America, Alibaba boss Jack Ma in China, and Ambani's in India. But after achieving their life goals, there was a change of mind, that of helping the society without any selfish motive. Very rarely we find someone who had believed strongly in altruism becomes a shrewd business person. This gives us an indication of which direction one's psychological growth in life takes place. Altruism is the next step one needs to take after one has followed Ayn Rand's philosophy, not before it. Ayn Rand did not always live by her own philosophy. She collected social security payments and Medicare later in life, something she was opposed to most of her life, justifying her action by saying it was a restitution for paying taxes earlier in life, as if one wrong can justify another. Someone who believes in non-violence should not become violent in response to violence, or a truthful person should not justify telling a lie on the grounds that he was also lied to. To conclude, we do need Ayn Rand's philosophy, and it's very appropriate that it's being taught to A-level students of political science in colleges and universities in modern times. Studying Ayn Rand will help us understand human nature, also altruism, and also to know the difference between healthy and unhealthy altruism. These courses will also provide a forum where young impressionable minds will get the opportunity to reflect on her ideas and challenge them in a rational way and be challenged by her ideas. Unless someone challenges our ideas, we will not be able to fine-tune our own thoughts about any theory or philosophy which is needed before we adopt them. Thank you. This audio was brought to you from the Emotions Clinic, Education and Training Center, Stoke-on-Trent, England.